last year, 2 weeks after this retreat ended, I got on a plane to Southeast Asia as kind of the forerunner to prepare the grounds for 14 other members of our community, including a number of people who are here, to participate in a pilgrimage, a Buddhist pilgrimage. And we started in Bangkok to kind of get our feet on the ground, you know, get over jet lag, start to bond as a sangha and a family halfway around the world, then flew to India and spent just about 3 weeks in India going to all of the major places of significance in the development of Buddhist thought and the events of the Buddha's life, and then crossed the border into Nepal and Lumbini, where the Buddha was born, and then flew to Kathmandu up through the Himalayas in a very small plane, and spent a little time in Kathmandu, and then flew back to Bangkok and then back home. And you know, a pilgrimage is a fascinating thing. You know, you have to really want to do a pilgrimage. It tests you, you know, because you're in foreign conditions, and this is, you're in northern India, which is the poorest of the poor of India. So the conditions are tough, and you see a lot of things just culturally, and with beggars and poverty and that are difficult, that are really challenging, and it's an important part of the trip of seeing that and learning how to deal with it effectively. And then, much like the original Sangha, you're going to places where the original Sangha actually was. We know they were there. And the model of the retreat is every morning we practice together. We sit and walk, and there's a Dharma talk, and we talk about the Dharma almost every single day. And then there's things we do in the afternoon, and in the evening we get together and do very much what we do here in our practice interviews. Get together and review the day and share, which is an extraordinary piece of the trip because of the intensity of it. So there's all kinds of expectations of what's going to be significant. You know, like these very significant places, and so you're going to have a significant experience at that significant place. And a lot of that happens. You know, I mean, it's a thrill. I mean, there are some places, like for me, but both times that I've done this, it's been Srivaste. And boy, you know, you're at a place where you know that the historical Sangha spent a minimum of 20 or 22 years of rains retreats. So, like, right where you are, right where you're practicing, you know, everybody you've ever read about and heard about was there. I mean, you're on the ground with them. And when I'm there, I mean, it's energetic. I just light up. You know, I feel like this true connection to those people and to my practice. But some of the most significant experiences are what on the surface look like completely mundane experiences and are wholly, completely unexpected, just like insight. You know, they're unanticipated. So the start of this talk is about one of those completely unanticipated exercises, and when you go from Bangkok to Bodh Gaya, which is the location that we believe where the Buddha was awakened, where this Mahabodhi temple is, you can fly now. Before you couldn't, but you fly from Bangkok to Gaya and then take a car ride in, a hair-raising car ride in from Buddha International Airport to Bodh Gaya. And so on the plane ride over, the plane was packed, and I just happened to be one of the, towards the end of getting on, and there were no aisle seats and no window seats, and so I sat down in a middle seat, and there was this Thai woman in the window seat. It was maybe 34, 36, and we tape off, and, you know, she's kind of working on her iPad, you know, and she's, and it's like mostly photos and things, you know. So out of the corner of my eye, I'm kind of looking, and, you know, there's all the pictures of all of her dogs, and she's got multiple dogs, and then there's the pictures of her sisters, and then the pictures of who I assume is her husband. So at some point, you know, just trying to get a little discussion, I said, you know, are you a dog lover? She goes, oh, yeah, you want to see my dogs, you know. And so we start going through this pictorial review of her life. I mean, it was quite endearing, you know, for somebody you don't know. You know, like, here's Jerry, you know, my dog, and here's... So to make a long story short, we get in this very nice discussion. She came to the U.S. For college in Arizona, met the man who would subsequently become her husband, a Spanish man. And now they kind of spend half of their time, the majority of their time in Thailand, and part of their time in Arizona. So he can be near his family, but, you know, he's been willing to basically move to Thailand and, you know, figure out how to live in that culture and everything. So it's a nice love story, you know, it's really nice. So I say to her, well, you know, why are you going to Bodh Gaya? And she just kind of like, almost like a throwaway line, says, oh, well, you know, my parents are going on pilgrimage, and I'm going with them. And then just immediately goes back to, you know, well, here's Jerry, my dog, kind of discussion. You know, so, oh, okay. So I kind of get the impression that, like, you know, she's just along for the ride, you know, with her parents. Well, make a long story short, you know, this is a fairly good ride, and we start to get in, you know, she says, well, why are you here? And I said, well, there's 15 of us, and, you know, we're on a pilgrimage. And, oh, really? Yeah, well, people tell me about that. And I subsequently find out this is a test. She's vetting me. So I tell her this, and, oh, really, really? So is the first time you've been to India? I said, no, I've been twice before, and once was pilgrimage. Oh, really, really? Until I got that one. And then, well, once she figures I'm for real, she then really tells me who she is, and who she is her whole family is devoted to the Dharma, and her father was a businessman in Bangkok and is retired, and has now devoted his life to the Dharma and building a Dharma center in Chiang Mai. And it's the kind of the traditional model where there's a whole series of small little kutis for one or two people, and then a Dharma hall and an eating hall. And so we get in, and she's got photos of this. It's in construction, it's about 80% done. And in two nights I'm going to talk about part of their project, which is extraordinary. What they're doing there with this little retreat center. But, you know, I suddenly find out that this person next to me isn't, you know, a little person on her iPad. Uh-huh. I mean, like, this is one serious practitioner. And so we start talking about the Dharma. And this was one of the two or three or four highlights of this entire trip for me. This ride and this discussion with this young woman, because first of all, she was really knowledgeable. I mean, she really knew the Dharma. But what was so amazing about it was the simplicity of her practice, in the sense that we've been talking about it here. And what I mean by that is that there was no separation between her practice and her life. None at all. So the idea that, like, well, gee, I'm a meditator, and then I've got this other part of my life, or, you know, however you frame it, wasn't there. You know, it's a seamless web. And she understood and could explain how any teaching that I would bring up directly applied to her life, and more importantly, how her mind works. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was really clear that the focus of practice was understanding these teachings in terms of how our mind works and either makes us suffer or points our mind in happiness. I mean, there was nothing theoretical about it. And the same kinds of things that we would talk about, and then we talk in group, and you know, we're all kind of struggling with, well, what does that mean? Not with her. I mean, her practice was so clear. And the other thing that was, for me, so fantastic about it is that she understood that where this practice really takes off is when you start framing questions and learning how to frame questions from a Dharmic or Buddhist perspective rather than from a conventional perspective. And what I mean by that is that she was not looking outside of herself to assign any responsibility to any event or person for her states of mind. That the compass always pointed inwards, and the examination inward wasn't psychological in a Western perspective. It was about the foundations of mind states. So anger may manifest itself, you know, because of 20 different circumstances in our life, but anger is always going to roll out in the same way. Anger has characteristics. So that rather than looking to the event or the person that was causing her anger, she would look to the mechanism of mind. And I aspire to have a practice like that. And I aspire to try to be able to teach in a way that helps people have a practice like that. It's just one of the real highlights of that trip. I mean, it really set the trip for me. Like, you know, like you have an idea of why you're there, and I got off that plane and I knew why I was there after being with her. Is that powerful, you know? So, what I'd like to talk about tonight is kind of we're trying to make these talks a progression, and John. I talked the opening night about the Satipatthana Sutra, and then I followed up with causation and these two elements of the Satipatthana, you know, of like how to use those, how to frame those. And tonight's talk, I want to talk about causation, which is the psychology of Buddhism. And then my next talk is on anatta. Okay. And the way I want to do this is and I said this the other night, I'm really firmly convinced that if we understand the Buddhist practice, that it is amazingly informative. So that's where I want to go again. And I want to approach this to try to really understand that story. I've tried to understand it if it were me. You know, like I left my family, but something was that important for me. And then I went to the best teachers. I went to John and Joseph Goldstein. And this next part is know, kind of radical. This is complete bullshit. But I find both of them wanting. and leave them, okay? And then I do all of these practices that almost kill me. I mean, I'm that dedicated, you know? And then I realize that that's not working. And this core group of people that I've been working with, practicing with through all of this, I walk away from them and they shun me. So my whole support system is gone. And I'm in a place, and so I show up in Bodh Gaya. I'm sitting under a tree. And where I am is, I know what doesn't work, but I don't know what does work. You know, we have this, well, we know the end of the story, right? You know, we know all the teachings. Well, he didn't at this point. It's like, It's like really extraordinary, that amount of effort as a human being you put in. So I think just before his awakening and then the night of his awakening, there are a series of shifts that inform actually what we do every day when we're sitting here. Okay, so the first one is he had realized that denying or trying to suppress the body and the senses and what was coming through those was not going to work. That it was in fact counterproductive, and that in some way they had to be included. You know, he wasn't sure how. You know, later we know that he made the determination that the bodies and the sense doors, as I will get to, are the actual vehicles for awakening. At this point, you know, just before, he didn't realize that, but he knew that they had to be included. And just thinking that as a possibility was a shift from all of the fundamental practices of the day. Okay. So that's the first one. The second one is his sutta says that on the night of his awakening, just before he kind of makes this vow that he's not going to get up unless he gets awakened, is he just has a recollection. And the recollection of it is when he was a younger man, and he was in a field under a tree, and he was concentrating very hardly, very strongly with his eyes closed, thinking about an issue. And he pulled back on the effort. You know, rather than concentrating, he pulled back on the effort and opened his mind, and what happened was spontaneously he had insight into the situation. And then the sutta says, you know, well, maybe the answer is not all this effort and force and suppression that I've been using, but maybe it's relaxing and opening the mind, and that spontaneous insight will appear. He didn't conclude that that was in fact the case, but it's like just before this evening, he's now entertaining that as a possibility. And, you know, I kind of feel that like these two things together are the start of what we know as Vipassana, you know, where you establish a basis, a foundation of concentration, and then open up and explore, right? You know, and that it's also the start of the middle way. You know, like these extreme practices aren't going to do it. That is not the way. You know, so backing off on the effort, finding a place where I can be more comfortable, where I can open up my mind and receive the wisdom of my body and my mind. So he goes into deep meditation, and you know, there's different versions of the description of that, and all these little dramatic versions of that you hear, but if you read the sutta, it's very clear what the awakening itself was about, and I want to focus on a very specific part of it, and that is the issue of causation. Okay. And so the really significant piece for this talk of the Buddha's awakening is that he spontaneously saw into the fact that suffering was a process that unfolded in the body and the mind that you could clearly see and understand through direct experience, not through thought, and that by doing that, you could see the way out of suffering. This was the seminal moment, and he said the awakening wasn't seeing how suffering arises, as critical as that was. The awakening was complete when he saw how to eliminate suffering. Okay? So this is seminal to our understanding of meditation practice, and maybe even to how we practice here, because, you know, just think back a couple of days, how often you're struggling and your instinct is to ignore something, to get away from it, to use force to suppress it. You know, all of these ways other than just be with it, okay, to understand it. And so this night of awakening, the shift is enormous, because up to that point, all of the focus was on suppression, force, denial of the body, of sensations in the body, and of thoughts. In the concentration practices, we're getting into these rarefied states of mind where everything disappears, including thoughts. And the austerity practices were all based on willpower and force. You know, I am not going to allow the sense doors, you know, to be influenced. So suddenly, everything changes. I mean, think of what a radical change this is. Everything goes from force and suppression to pulling back the reins a little bit, opening up, receiving, and waiting for insight. It's just extraordinary, you know. And it's not, there wasn't anything going on at that time, a model like that, that you can point to that said, oh, well, you know, a lot of the teachings, the Buddha would take them and modify them slightly, you know, adapt them. But there's nothing going on like that any place in India that we know of at the time where you could say, oh, well, you know where he got that idea from, so-and-so or the certain sect, you know. So the causation that he saw, so after his awakening, he gave three talks in succession. The first talk outlined the Four Noble Truths. The second talk outlined anatta. The third talk outlined causation, what he had seen. Okay. So the causation that he saw was of several types. Okay. The first one was general causation, which helps us understand what anicca, impermanence, is, and also is at the base of anatta. And it is the idea that everything is changing, but it's not just changing, it's changing for particular reasons. So that we're not just attacked by a thought, but there's a reason that it appears. And the reason that it appears, anything that is in this moment, is dependent on the moment before. So it just doesn't appear on its own. Any state of mind, that there are conditions that appear before it, and from those conditions, you know, back to what causes something to arise. Okay? There are conditions, and it causes the mind state to arise. So the first thing about this causation is that one moment is dependent on the moment that precedes it. And then that just keeps going on, right? Like this moment, and that moment, and now this moment. And so, you know, the simplest form of this is you're listening to this talk, right? And I hope this isn't a stretch, but you're going, wow, this is really interesting. And then for whatever reason, you get a little distracted and your attention wanes, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, what's he saying? Yeah, which is exactly what happens when we're sitting in meditation, right? So your energy goes down, your attention slides off the object of attention, which at the moment is this talk, sitting on the cushion, it's your breath or your body, and then, oh my gosh, you know. So you can just see into this if you watch closely enough. So the first is that it's dependent. The second is that each moment conditions or influences or colors the next. So if in this moment I'm experiencing frustration, that is going to color or influence the next moment. Okay. So that's the first part. That's a general causation. Okay. The second part that he signed to and the part that explains attachment, identification, and reactivity is what's called dependent origination. And in its simplest form, okay, at the moment of contact of one of our sense doors with an object, a consciousness arises at that moment. And every moment that arises where there is consciousness has a feeling tone to it. From a Buddhist perspective, they arise simultaneously. So consciousness does not arise independent of a feeling tone, okay? And anybody have any guess where the feeling tone comes from? It's influenced by the prior moment, but it comes from mental formations that we talked about, right? So consciousness arises, it has a feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or what we're calling neutral. Depending on what happens and how aware of it we are, the pleasant increases, intensifies up to desire. The unpleasant intensifies or increases up to aversion. And then if at that point, as practitioners, we don't see that and work with it somehow or what have you, it begins to escalate up into attachment. So it's very energetic, right? It just starts as kind of a feeling tone, and then it starts to get stronger as desire, aversion, and then it starts to restrict itself to hold on. Attachment is, you know, holding on to a belief, an opinion, an object, a person, whatever it may be. And then depending on how tight that attachment gets, it turns into identification. You know, I'm identified with this. So the simplest form of this is, you know, I'm in negotiations with my grandson, my daughter, one of my clients, an opposing attorney, it doesn't matter who, and I have a position. And I can have that position and not allow it to, somebody opposing that position, to trigger me, you know, because I'm holding it lightly, right? You know, it's important to me, but I'm holding it lightly, okay? But if I don't have a sense of humor, and I'm really holding that thing tightly, and somebody starts to attack my position or challenge me, then I start to take it personally, right? Okay? So it's all a question of the degree to which it's holding on, and then it's like that. And so I always remember, what I always try to remind myself when I start negotiating with someone is, does everybody know who Wavy Gravy is? You know, he was a character of the 60s and is still around, has a foundation and everything. You know, a clown, a real clown. And he had this little saying that if you don't have a sense of humor, it's not very funny. You know, so I always remember that, you know. And that's helpful to remember sometimes when you're sitting. You know, that story that I told the other night about, you know, I'm sitting on the cushion here and suddenly, you know, having these thoughts like, what in the world am I doing thinking those thoughts, you know? It's like, that's just preposterous, right? As opposed to, you know, getting upset about it, right? So that creates space around the issue. So, where was I? So dependent origination moves through this sequencing. And so that's what the Buddha saw the night of his awakening. And he realized that that wasn't intellectual. I mean, you can feel that in your body. I mean, you can feel pleasant, unpleasant. You can feel desire. You can feel the desire getting stronger. You can feel, you know, you're starting to clamp down on something. You can feel it starting to become personal. And then this part, you know, we kind of go unconscious, but, you know, at some point you identify with it and you're basically unconscious, right? You're just gone. You know, now I'm just acting out of habit and, you know, fight, flight, all this stuff. So The reason that this was so significant is that we can actually experience each one of these things I just talked about, and if you think about it, that's what we've been talking about, right? I mean, we're working through these. Yeah. Okay, what is it that our mind's holding on to? Yeah. How strong, how intense is that? You know, so there's, it's both we can see it and we can practice with it. That's the extraordinary thing about his seeing this and the clarity of it. You know, it's not like there's a bunch of theories behind this, although there's a bunch of explanations. But in terms of practice, if you understand causation and you have basic practice, you can do that. You don't have to read a million suttas. Very, very powerful. You know, so back to the simplicity idea. So this is like this huge seminal shift. So where does this issue of causation start? You know, this is back to these teachings are not theories. They are deep, deep experiential observations that took place that we can replicate. Okay, so how does this happen? Okay, from a Buddhist perspective, we have six sense doors, right? We've got our five normal sense doors, and then we've got the mind with sense, mental impressions. And the Buddhist idea is that there is a consciousness for each sense door. Now, we tend to think of it being unitary, right? Like that all of these things are coming together and what have you, and they are very quickly. But even with physics and everything else, we know that these discrete things are happening. So the idea is that assuming that my eardrum is healthy and someone hits the cabinet in the back, that vibration comes, touches my eardrum, and there is contact. And at that moment of contact, hearing consciousness arises, and there is a feeling tone to that, and there's a sensation, because whatever that was touched my ear. So sensation, contact, consciousness, feeling tone. That's the start of everything. And every single experience we have starts that way. So it starts here, starts at our nose, at our mouth, starts touching our skin, an impression touching our mind. It's all the same. So there are six sense doors. There are three feeling tones. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So there are 18 possibilities that each sense door can be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this is happening over and over and over and over and over again. So all consciousness, from a Buddhist perspective, starts in the body. And all consciousness and all suffering or happiness or mindfulness starts at the moment of contact. Are we together so far? So this moment of contact is a pretty big deal, right? And so you're probably saying, oh my God, now it's going to be, I have to make all this effort to watch for this moment of contact. That's just impossible. Okay. So another exercise. Okay, I was talking about this unremarkable bush out here, which I'm sure all of you now recognize is actually a remarkable bush. But just to kind of if this was a Thursday night at SIM, I would suggest this, which we can't do right now. I would say go out to Arden Mall Shopping Center and just pick out a busy place and just sit there and then just look forward, you know, like maybe 10 feet. And just keep your eyes for that 10 feet. That's all. And somebody's going to walk by. Don't follow them, okay? just watch that and watch what happens. And everyone who does this exercise comes back and says, I can't believe how many judgments my mind makes. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody comes, I don't even know who these people are. All I see is like their pants or their shoes or something, and I have a reaction to it. Right? It's like, oh, I really like that. Can you believe that they've got that on? You know, like, what a slob. Well, that's an attractive person. Yeah. Right? And so you just watch, and this pleasant, unpleasant, just escalating quickly, it's inescapable. So I don't want to suggest that you go to the store and get a romance novel, a Coca-Cola, and a candy bar. So the alternative to that is, in terms of one of the walking periods, just taking a little bit of time, like out in the garden or something. And it doesn't have to be that. It could be out in the back where there's the fence and a tree. And just walk up and just put your eyes down, take a breath, and then look up at what's in front of you and see what happens. And see if it's true that something happens. That's it. That's what the Buddha said, right? Try it out. And my guess is that you will find out, even with no practice of this particular thing, the majority of the time, what you look at, you're going to see that there's some kind of a experience that happens, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, or it's already up to desire, or it's already up to aversion, or you look at it and have a memory about something, or you have a thought about something. Okay? So this is the easiest way to verify the truth of this fundamental, important teaching of the historical Buddha. And then, if you find that to be true, then, from my perspective, you and I and we have a very powerful starting place for looking at our experience and trying to see the rolling out of our states of mind at an earlier stage than we're used to. Because we're looking for it. Once again, this is a training, right? I mean, we're not used to looking this way. And I have two ways of thinking about this. The first way is when I was in my 20s, I had a house with a big backyard in it, and there was on the perimeter of the grass, there were kind of like all these bushes and weeds, and I didn't keep them cut very well. So it was always kind of like a little jungle back there, you know. And I had two Siamese cats, Sarah and Amy, and one was a classical seal point, you know, with that beautiful head, and the other one was a girl too. They were litter mates, but looked like a male. She was looked like a tomboy, but she was a seal point. She's, you know, fantastic. And Amy lived to be 21, and Sarah, the one I'm going to talk about, lived to be 23. Unbelievable. And Sarah slept in bed with me next to my chest for 23 years. Boy, when that little animal died, I mean, it was something. So she would, you know, I'd let them out in the backyard, and she would go over to one section of this foliage, you know, this little jungle, and she would just lay down. You know how the cats, they just lay down, and then she'd just stay there. And at first I thought, well, you know, she's just going out there and taking a nap. And then, of course, what I realized is, you know, like, talk about patience. She would sit there for hours just waiting. She knew, she could hear, you know, that there were little, just wait. And then, of course, you know, I'd open up the back door, and she'd run in the house, and she'd be so proud of herself, and she would have brought something in for me, right? And amazingly, she'd never kill it. She'd just catch it, and it was like, "Hey, Dad, I got something for you. You know, I'm so proud." And then I'd pick it up and take it out and put it back, and then she'd try to catch it the next day. So I kind of think, you know, one way about this moment of contact, you know, and this arising is kind of like that. Like, we're sitting in meditation, and it's the same way the Buddha said, you know, like, pull back on the reins, relax, open up, but part of your intention is to watch, you know, for this. Not every moment, but it's an intention. And it's like, I'm just paying, you know, wow, there, I saw it that time, you know. So that's one analogy. The other one is, I think, of Jane Goodall, you know, out in the jungle with all these primates, right? And this is kind of extending it. This is why the moment of contact becomes so important, is that, you know, think about that woman. What an incredible story of her being out there and just hanging out, right? Well, what's she doing? She's watching, and watching closely enough and long enough without intervening that she's seeing patterns that she can identify. Right? What's meditation about? Right? So the instruction, you know, basically, well, just sit there, like, don't fool around with it, okay? Don't change it. Don't try to control it. Don't modify it unless it gets to the point where it's counterproductive. Okay? There's always that. Okay. But absent getting to that point, the job is just to sit there and watch in the same way that Jane Goodall was sitting there and watching. And it's like, how does this work? And this is what this Thai girl, this Thai woman, had done. She knew, she had sat and watched her mind, and she knew what the patterns were. She knew what anger or frustration felt like and how it arose in her body, you know, what, how it arose, how it sustained, and how it passed away. She knew that. And so this fundamental instruction of stay with it, you know, don't go back to the pre-awakening model. Suppress it, deny it, avoid it, use force on it. Just open to it, soften to it, receive it. Understand it. And I think one of the models of understanding practice, you know, we all have to find out what works for us. But this is much more a practice of receiving the experience that is arising in us than anything else. We're not trying to make something happen. We're not trying to create something. We're not going to make insight appear. Doesn't happen that way. And so this willingness to stay present and be kind and do what we need to do to not move into resistance and just receive what's happening, even if it's pain, becomes the conditions that we're laying that result in spontaneous insight arising. And then we have the experience that the historical Buddha had. That we begin to understand this causation. So that might look like you're having pain, you know, and struggling with it. And rather than turning away from it and trying to make it go away, and you know, this contact issue, I'll get back to pain, and if I don't, somebody tell me to. This contact issue is so subtle because here's the most common example. I'm sitting in meditation, and there's some discomfort in my hip. And so, you know, I move or, you know, I do something and now I'm comfortable again. Most of the time, we don't even know that happened. Or we're so identified with it, we move and stuff and it doesn't even cross our mind that this is a practice issue. Right? We just move. Well, I'm uncomfortable, I'm supposed to move. Right? So, we completely go by, I mean, and this is the most mundane and maybe the most profound moment. We go by the fact that there is a moment of contact occurring here where my hip is in contact with this and it's unpleasant, and that has gone up to aversion, and now I want to move. I mean, there, that's the whole ballgame, right there. That's the whole reason we suffer in its safest form to deal with. So actually beginning to see that there are all these moments of contact that we're having that we just go right by them. And if we actually practice with these really simple, small things, then they lead to our ability to practice with bigger things. If we start with, well, I'm going to, that really terrible pain I'm having, I'm going to start watching for the contact. Well, probably the wrong place to start, you know? But all these little things, you know, it's a gradual training our mind. So, back to pain, the same theory. You're suffering some pretty good pain, and rather than turning away from it, you say, okay, well, my intention is to stay with it. And then you start to see it's really hard to do that. And just depending on how the retreat goes, in one of our afternoon sessions, we may do a session just on pain, just as a discrete thing. Some things I've been working with at the Pain Center at UC Davis. But for our purposes here, so you see that for some reason, and you're not sure what it is, in the same way the Buddha wasn't sure, that I'm having real trouble staying here. I can't stay here. So you just keep trying things, and then just through that trial and error process, almost inevitably, what you begin to see is that unless you're willing to accept that that pain is there and you're going to be with it, it's going to be very, very hard to be with it. Because if you don't accept it, you're trying to get away from it. You know, you're kind of feeling that I don't want that in my life. It doesn't have a legitimate purpose in my life. One of the people in one of the groups said that they were so angry at their body for having the pain. You know, so like, just a form of denial. All these things. I mean, we don't want pain in our life. So, and I don't mean acceptance in the sense of, well, okay, I accept it. I'm going to be in pain for the rest of my life. I mean, the fact that that is reality at this moment. And my commitment as a Buddhist and as a practitioner is to deal with reality and to accept that. And that's the start of then, how do I open to it? And then you have a basis to start opening to it. So you say, okay, I'll try it. So I accept it. And then you find it's still hard. So you start watching. And then you realize that to the degree that you resist it, it intensifies it. So then, well, I've got to pull back. And how far back on my effort do I pull so I can be with this and not fall asleep or get drowsy? And how much effort do I use where it not only intensifies it, but it makes me anxious and restless? So what is it? It's all trial and error, right? This whole practice. Each one of us experimenting with our own life, our own pain. In our body. So we could take any one of, you know, like we say, name the mind state. And we would go through a similar drill. One period I recognize that a real driver of everything in my life was fear. I knew I was really anxious. I knew I was an anxious, insecure kid, and then I became an anxious, insecure adult. Wow. I should put that on my resume. So I kept looking at that, and I realized that those actually were symptoms. That really wasn't my problem. My problem was is that I was afraid. That I was afraid of people, and that I was afraid of my ability just to be in the world. So when I got that, I was at a young enough age where I was kind of like Renee, I said, I'm just going to take this on. I'm just going to eat this alive. So I heard this talk by Joseph Goldstein, and it's a two. It's now on Dharma Seed. Then it was two tape cassettes. There wasn't any Dharma Seed where you could, download it. There's two talks, and he basically lays out this theory of working with any strong aversive mind state. And it's basically like, figure out a situation that is going to raise that state of mind for you. You can do it both in sitting meditation and in real life. And then intentionally bring yourself up to, he talked about an edge, the edge where you start to feel threatened by whatever that is. And then get right up to that edge and then just stay there for a little bit. And maybe at the beginning it's 10 seconds or maybe it's 30 seconds or maybe it's a minute. But just stay there and see what happens. And what you start to see is that the minute you get close, whatever your favorite, fear is, that your mind jumps way ahead to potentially what might happen to you and everything. And now you're thinking about it. You're not actually in the experience. So he said, just get up right to that edge and experience it and then pull back. And then, what happened? And then, of course, what you start to see is, that felt kind of scary, but, geez, I'm okay. Right? I thought that if I got up there, it's going to devour me, or it's going to kill me, or it's going to disable me, or something. So then you get up there, and you do it again, and you get up there, and you do it again, and maybe the third or fourth time, you get up to there, and where before you'd start getting all kinds of triggers, you get up there, and you're not getting triggered. Okay? So then you say, I'll push it a little further. So then you wait a little bit further into whatever that mind state is, and then that whole thing comes up again. And then you watch it. How does it arise? How does it sustain? What causes it to go down? So you've got those three questions, and it's just a workshop, right? And then you just keep doing that. So you start out, and, metaphorically, you start off here, and after 3 or 4 or 5 months, you're way up here in terms of dealing with that state of mind. And it actually happens. So that's what I started doing, and then I started getting kind of crazy with it, and I said, I'm going to really take on where I'm going to test myself with fear. So I started skydiving and all kinds of stuff, and it really worked. There was this movie, what's it called? It's not a very good movie, but it's called Breakpoint, and that's with. He's dead now. He died of cancer. He was a dancer.
Patrick Swayze.
Patrick Swayze. Okay. So there's a scene in this movie where they go up in a small plane, just exactly like if you go commercial skydiving, small plane, and they take you up, and there's the whole scene of being up there, and you're up there, and you're talking everything, and then they turn on this light, and when that light goes on, you get really serious because you're in the drop zone. And then everybody gets into a particular position, and everybody checks all. There's all these things that you check, these safety devices and everything. And then you go out the door, and you go out the door in a certain way. Okay? So what I would do is I would get into meditation for like a half hour, 45 minutes, and I'd have I'd have the TV set to this part of the movie. And so, I'm really, really calm and everything. I'd open my eyes and I'd turn on this part of the movie. And it's amazing. I turn it on and I was going to use a metaphor. I get very nervous. It's amazing. Just like you're in such a quiet, open place. And it's like, oh my God, that's frightening. So I just kept doing that. And then pretty soon it's like, I felt really comfortable with this. So I said, I'll go try it for real. So then I went and I did a bunch of skydiving, And so it was this whole progression of dealing with fear, and I still have a bunch of fear in my life. But the difference between when I started on this and where I am now is like extraordinary. You know, it's like internally I feel like I'm almost a different person. So for me, all of this goes back to the moment of contact and watching this roll out and how powerful it can be as a tool for us. So I encourage you to do this little exercise, you know, tomorrow, going out and just testing it. You know, see if the Buddha was right or not. Like, look at something. Actually, when your eye comes in contact with something, does something happen? When you're sitting out here at breakfast and you hear a bird chirp, the moment of contact, is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Okay. Yeah. Just you look at your plate of food. Contact. What happens? You take your first bite. What happens? And if something happens, maybe there's something in this for you, for all of us. And I believe, I mean, I think it's just so clear that if you read the Sutta and everything I'm talking about precedes the Buddha giving the Satipatthana Sutra, the talk on the four foundations of mindfulness. This is the foundation of the Satipatthana Sutra. Causation, if you take causation, this causation away, the Satipatthana Sutra means something totally different. This is the foundation of the four foundations of mindfulness. Okay? So, I think if we examine this and look at it and try it, that it has the potential that in every moment we have the possibility of seeing the causation that leads to our suffering or our happiness, and in every moment there's the possibility of liberation. If we can actually see that, we have a choice. If we don't see it, don't have a choice. Okay, so let's sit just a second.